From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Florida Governor Rick Scott said today that he supports raising the minimum age to buy a gun from 18 to 21 and would back a ban on bump stocks. And President Trump told a group of conservatives that he supports giving guns to some teachers in schools. But earlier in the day, the president said this about the armed school resource officer in Parkland, Florida, who did not intervene to stop the gunman responsible for killing 17 people on campus.
That's a case where somebody was outside. They're trained. They didn't react properly under pressure, or they were cowards. It was a real shot to the police department.
Joining us now is Herman Lopez, a senior reporter for Vox who's covered gun legislation for years. Herman, welcome.
Hi.
And given what we know about this armed deputy that was at Stoneman Douglas High School but did not act to stop the gunman, how much of a difference would it make to, as President Trump is suggesting, armed teachers in schools?
Yeah, there have actually been a few simulations, right, and studies where they essentially look at how people react in these kinds of environments, these mass shooting or other criminal environments. And what you generally see is that people panic. A lot of the times, they quite frankly just don't react in time. And in these simulations, they get shot before they shoot anybody else. So it's not really that surprising that this would happen. That seems to be what happened with this deputy, in that he just did not react for as long as 6 minutes. And there's also FBI data that speaks to this. About almost half of cases where law enforcement responds to an active shooting scenario, they get injured or killed. And these are people who are really trained to do this full time. And even they have a pretty high injury rate as a result. So, there's good reason for people to be panicking in these situations.
Just in the midst of the chaos, it's very difficult to get your gun, aim it perfectly, and hit your target while they may be shooting at you.
Right. I mean, if you talk to people who train like officers in this stuff, they will tell you, yeah, there's this perception that this works like a video game. But no, life is not like that. There's adrenaline pumping. There's fear. There's like you might not be that accurate of a shot in the first place. And all of that creates problems.
Another proposal coming from the Trump White House is to raise the age limit to buy a gun. The shooter in this case was 19 years old. Would that make a difference?
I mean, it would have made it impossible for him to legally purchase this weapon within Florida, at least, right? So maybe he wouldn't have actually obtained the gun that he used to actually carry out the shooting. But when you look more broadly about that, I mean, it's essentially a change that is so small in the grand scheme of things. In terms of like, I mean, could he have traveled to another state to obtain the firearm? Could other people just travel across state lines to obtain firearms if they're 19 or whatever? And also, in general, there's just a question of like how much these bans that target specific assault weapons might have an effect just because people can travel across state lines.
Well, and in fact, the Washington Post has compiled a database of 150 mass shootings since 1966. They were not gang-related, and they were carried out by a lone shooter, and the data show that more than 85% of the shooters were over the age of 21.
Yeah, that's right. And that opens the question of, like, just how effective can this specific proposal be, not just for mass shootings, but also more broadly. A lot of crime in the U.S. is driven by handgun shootings and those other kinds of weapons. So it's not totally clear that stopping someone from buying this kind of weapon, especially with such a limited age restriction, would make a huge dent in U.S. gun violence overall.
Another proposal that President Trump has gotten behind is better background checks. I wonder what you think of that. What could we be doing to make the background checks better, and would that make more of a difference?
So in general, if you actually did universal background checks, there's good research that suggests that would have an impact. Missouri in particular had a law where they had universal background checks essentially for handguns. And in 2007, they repealed the law, and you saw an immediate increase that year in gun homicides. Particularly gun homicides. Other kinds of homicides, non-firearm homicides, did not increase. So that suggests that, yes, there is some effect attached to these universal background checks. But the thing with what Trump has proposed, so far the White House has only clarified that he supports one bill working through the Senate right now, which would only encourage states and federal agencies to do better reporting to the background check system. But that's a far cry from actually making every gun sale require a background check, which is simply not the case in the U.S. right now.
One more thing President Trump is talking about, and that is banning bump stocks. This is what was used in the Las Vegas attack to turn a semi-automatic weapon into basically an automatic weapon. Would that do much to deter shootings?
I mean, in the case of Florida, it would have done nothing, right? Because this guy did not use a bump stock. I mean, these are devices that can make guns deadlier. So presumably, if you limit access to them, if you ban them altogether, that will make it harder to carry out. I mean, the Las Vegas shooting was the deadliest in U.S. history. It was like the amount of people who were injured is in the hundreds. It was a truly horrific event. And presumably it would have helped there. But when you start looking at, well, mass shootings are only a small percent of overall U.S. gun deaths, and you start asking, like, how many people actually use bump stocks, there's a good question of, like, how big of an effect would such a mild measure like this one actually have?
That's Herman Lopez, who's a senior reporter with Vox. Herman, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
And so much of this week's remarkable debate over guns has to do with the amplification it's receiving via social media. Femi Okay is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, and she joins us now from Washington with more. Hi there, Femi.
Hello there.
So obviously there's a lot of conversation on social media on both sides of this debate. Let's first start with what you've seen online from opponents of further gun restrictions.
So the hashtags that I'm looking at are 2A. Defend the Second, and obviously the NRA, that's the umbrella conversation that's happening for the part of the states that really is happy with the gun laws as they are. Here's the former Secret Service agent Dan Bongino. Gives you a little sample of what people are talking about. He says the defining characteristics of criminals is their scorn for the law, hashtag 2A. And then Cody Chambers, this is the passion that is behind this part of the debate. He has hashtag defend the second. And then he says, my AR-15 still hasn't killed anyone. Maybe it's broken. Some snark, some sarcasm, referring, of course, to the semi-automatic rifle that was used in the Parkland shooting last week. And then the NRA TV describes itself as America's most patriotic team on a mission to take back the truth. And they have so many videos, clips, being very persuasive, if you're already in that camp, about why the gun laws are perfectly okay as they are.
Right. So then on the other side of the debate, there's a lot of hashtags over there. One in particular I want to talk about, hashtag dump the NRA. Tell us about it and what impact it's had.
This is interesting because with social media, you get to talk to customer services, you get to talk to the companies if they want to talk back to you. Tim Peacock is a writer, so he tweeted to Hertz, Avis, Budget, Enterprise, Alamo, National Pro, or car companies, vehicle rental companies. He says, this is what the NRA stands for. Are you going to continue sponsoring their efforts to stall legislation that could save children's lives? Alamo tweets back, thanks for contacting us. We ended the program effective March the 26th. So that conversation between customers and the organisations who may well be supporting or funding or having doing business with the NRA, sometimes those companies are stepping away. First National Bank is a good example of this. They say customer feedback has caused us to review our relationship with the NRA. As a result, the First National Bank of Omaha will not renew its contract with the National Rifle Association to issue the NRA Visa card. And this boycott campaign, the hashtag for it is dump the NRA.
Well, let's step away from the debate over guns for a moment and move on to something else that happened on social media, because February is Black History Month. And in Illinois, Governor Bruce Rauner participated in a diversity demonstration at a celebration in Chicago. Now, Rauner's white, and in this demonstration, he was holding a glass of milk, while Hyatt Hotels executive Tyrone Stoudemire, who's Black, poured in chocolate syrup. And so we got a little tape here. Let's listen.
This chocolate syrup represents diversity. Women, people of color, people with disabilities, the aging population, Generation X, Y, and Z. It's not that organizations are not diverse, but when you look at most organizations, diversity sits what? At the bottom of the organization. You don't get inclusion until you actually stir it up. I want you to stir it up, Governor. Stir it up.
So that was Stoudemire there. Lots of reaction online.
You get chocolate milk. Excellent. Diversity, inclusivity. Eric Berlin tweets, Illinois governor drinks glass of chocolate milk to prove commitment to diversity. This is the most Onion-esque headline to ever not appear in The Onion. This story is trending on Facebook right now. It's hilarious. Watch the video. Go on Facebook and watch the video. It is very well-meaning, but it does show you what happens when analogies go bad.
Okay. Well, we have 30 seconds here, Femi. I have to ask you about
that's enough
about Kylie Jenner.
Yes,
one tweet costing Snapchat $1 billion in market value.
So Kylie Jenner, one of the luscious young Kardashians, tweeted, so does anyone else not open Snapchat anymore? And then Snapchat lost $1.6 billion of their stock market value. So if you ever doubted the worth of the Kardashians, that is one example that proves it.
Yikes. Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you as always, Femi.
My pleasure.
On Sunday night, the Olympic Games come to a close, so you'll need something new to binge on TV. Seven shows are set to debut Monday on cable and network TV, and NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to talk about a few of them. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And first of all, I have to say I'm going to miss the Olympics. I think that they've been really great this year. What do you think?
It's been interesting because I think some of the American athletes that NBC was positioning to sort of be big stars, their stories didn't turn out necessarily the way NBC thought, but we discovered new people, which I thought was really interesting. You know, Adam Rippon is the
right
one that occurs to me. But it also forced viewers, I think, to pay attention to stars from other countries.
Okay, well, if our TVs are tuned to NBC for the Olympics, your first pick of a show that we should watch after the Olympics is also on NBC. It's a drama called Good Girls. Tell us about it.
This is a show that features a cast of women who normally are in supporting roles. So Christina Hendricks from Mad Men, Retta from Parks and Recreation, and Mae Whitman from Parenthood. And they play these three friends. They're all struggling in their lives, and they realize that they could improve their lives if they actually got together and robbed a grocery store where Mae Whitman's character works. And they're all upstanding, you know, follow-the-rules kind of people who found themselves in places that they never expected to be. They thought their lives would turn out better if they followed the rules, and it turned out it didn't work out that way. And so now what we have here is we have a clip of the three of them talking. And it looks like they're joking, but really, they're not.
It's no big deal. All the stores I work at eventually get hit.
You could get shot.
Oh, one can hope. These guys, they don't want to hurt anybody. They just want the money, so we let them have it. Nobody's trying to be a hero. And you never dick around with the registers. The real money, it's back in the vault. You really worked this out.
Damn, I could use that money.
Oh, my God, me too.
So when do you want to do this?
You should see your face.
It's whiter than usual.
So Retta and Mae Whitman are pretending that they're joking, but eventually they get around to actually doing it. And this is a show that brings up a lot of issues about female empowerment. The creator of the show talked about creating it in the wake of Trump's victory and feeling like women's issues were being swept under the rug and not being paid attention to. And here we have three strong female characters trying to find agency in their lives. You know, one of them, Christina Hendricks' character, is being cheated on by her husband. Another one is married and has a child with a medical condition, Retta's character, and she needs a lot of money so that she can get treatment. And Mae Whitman's character is kind of a little lost and adrift and trying to find her place in the world. And so to see these strong female stories being told and coming together in this series, I think, is a really interesting note to strike at the end of February.
Okay, so Good Girls on NBC. Another show that you say is worth watching after the Olympics is Unreal, which is coming back for another season. This is a show, by the way, that one of my very close friends was in the first season. Brita Wool was on that show. And what are we going to see this season?
This is a fictional drama about the making of a reality dating show like The Bachelor, and was developed by a producer who used to work on The Bachelor, among other people. And so this show had a bit of a rocky second season. Now they're back, and in this season, they're actually going to do a bachelorette-type show where they're going to have a woman pick from amongst a bunch of male suitors. And in the clip that we have, the main character, the main executive producer of the show, Quinn, is trying to convince the head of the network that they should feature a woman on the show and let her be the one who's looking for a husband.
I know the brass upstairs is busting your balls about all this pink hat female empowerment crap and quotas. Serena ticks off a lot of boxes. I can get them off your back.
You do realize that your career is on life support, right?
Yes, Carrie.
But people like you cannot make the same mistake twice.
You mean women like me?
It's a go. But if this goes south like last year, you're fired.
And so, you know, there's always this question about if you work at a show that is this toxic, where the producers are always lying to the contestants, and the contestants are trying to do whatever they can to get more screen time, can you preserve yourself? Can you find yourself? Can you live a halfway decent life when part of your job involves lying to everybody all the time? And I think the show is best when it sticks to that theme. Sometimes, you know, the plot twists are kind of outlandish. So we'll see if they get their mojo back in this third season. It's very interesting to see all the issues of female empowerment. Once again, you know, the woman who's at the center, who's looking for a husband, is a high-powered executive, very successful. And you sort of say to yourself, can a woman like this be on a show like this without sort of abandoning every principle of feminism that she had going into the show? So it looks like it's going to be an interesting season.
All right, I want to ask you about one more show. This one is Living Biblically on CBS. It's executive produced by one of the stars of Big Bang Theory, Johnny Galecki. Tell us about this series.
Yeah, some people may remember that there was a book out where a journalist spent a year sort of living his life according to all the strictures that are in the Bible. Now they've decided to build a sitcom around a guy who's a film critic who actually decides to start living this way in reaction to the death of a friend. And then he eventually decides to write about it for the publication where he works. And, you know, it's kind of an awkward comedy. It's CBS, so it's very conventional. I don't think it's all that well done. I would recommend people don't necessarily waste their time watching it. But it is on CBS, so it's going to get a lot of eyeballs. And as you said, it is executive produced by Johnny Galecki from Big Bang Theory. And so it's interesting from that standpoint. But I thought the book itself was kind of a weird concept, and to try and make it into a sitcom is even stranger, especially on a conventional network like CBS that is never really going to, I think, ask very challenging questions about theology or about religion and how we relate to religion. It's going to be all kind of passed off as a sort of lighthearted joke, which if the show settles into a groove, it could be interesting. But the episodes I saw, just it wasn't quite there.
It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Well, the Canadian pastime of axe throwing hasn't made its way to primetime TV just yet, but the sport is hacking its way into the U.S. Ali Schweitzer from member station WAMU visited an axe throwing establishment in Washington, D.C. to find out why.
Rachel Horowitz is just a regular gal looking to grab a beer after work and throw deadly weapons. The Washington resident has just walked into Kraken Axes. It's what you might call an axe bar and one of the city's first axe-throwing establishments. Turns out, Horowitz is not a complete novice.
I've been to Renfest a lot, and I throw axes at Renfest, and it's a lot of fun.
Renfest, Maryland's Renaissance Festival, used to be one of the only axe-throwing destinations in the Washington area. But now there are two more, with others on the way. Horowitz and her friend Mark Swanhart are about to get a crash course in urban axe throwing. Their teacher is Kraken Axe's owner, Stuart Martins.
What's up, guys?
How's it going? Rachel.
Rachel, Stu.
Hey, Stu. Mark.
Mark, Stu, come on over.
Martins guides Horowitz and Swanhart toward a lane surrounded by protective nets. He fishes a short-handled axe out of a bucket on the concrete floor and positions himself about 10 feet in front of a big wooden target on the wall. Throwing an axe, he explains, isn't about strength. It's about finesse.
You want to create this rhythm with the axe where you're moving forwards and backwards. Get great momentum with the axe. And then when you're ready, you're going to lean and aim.
Martins easily nails the target. Horwitz and Swanhart seem a little intimidated.
What do you think? How does that look to you?
Easy, so simple.
Hurling axes sounds like something lumberjacks do for fun. But over the last 2 years, dozens of axe-throwing ranges have opened in cities across the U.S. The sport is an import, of course, from Canada.
It originated in essentially backyards.
Mario Zelaya owns the Ontario-based company Bad Axe Throwing.
We decided to commercialize the sport in Canada, and we started off with one location. And truthfully, we weren't sure if it was going to work.
But it did. In less than 2 years, Bad Axe Throwing has expanded to 8 U.S. locations, including one in D.C. The sport has been such a hit in the district that Bad Axe plans to open another local spot later this year. Zelaya says the Washington area is a fantastic market for axe throwing, largely because there are a lot of corporate customers here. He says many employers consider axe throwing a great team-building exercise, and Zelaya predicts that in a couple of years, his sport of choice is going to be everywhere.
Just like how bowling started, you know, all those years ago, and it's now become a household name, axe throwing is going to be that next bowling.
And that could be. But like bowling, throwing an axe well isn't as easy as it looks.
This is not going to go well.
Back at Kraken Axes, Rachel Horwitz is having a tough time landing her axe inside the target. It keeps flipping around in the air and smacking into the wall. Her friend Mark Swanhart has better luck. After repeatedly throwing and failing, he finally sticks the axe.
Nice! How do you feel right now?
I feel fantastic.
The sensation, he says, is exhilarating. At the end of this entree into axe throwing, Swanhart and Horwitz managed to walk away with all their fingers, not to mention a new way to blow off steam after work. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Schweitzer in Washington.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
For those who like to read the Warren Buffett tea leaves, it's going to be a big weekend. On Saturday, the billionaire investor is releasing his annual letter to Berkshire Hathaway shareholders. He's done this for more than 50 years. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And do you have an advance copy?
Oh, no, I don't. No.
Okay. But people are really anticipating what he might say about the economy.
Oh, yeah. And these are such fun reads. And you don't have to even be an investor not to like this guy, because he uses the letter. He outlines the plans for the company. He reflects on performance. But he does have this wonderful market wisdom. He's got some great barbs, a good sense of humor. One of my favorite ones, I have to say, was back in 2016. And this is my favorite quote from that letter. When trillions of dollars are managed by Wall Streeters charging high fees, it will usually be the managers who reap outsized profits, not the clients.
Now, he's 87 years old, Warren Buffett is. People have been wondering what the succession plan is for him. Do we know much about that as of now?
Well, we've got two younger guys who have been named as executives at Berkshire, Gregory Abel and Ajit John. They were both appointed to the company's board as vice chairs in January. They're the most likely candidates. So both of them are very low key. Jane runs the reinsurance business. He joined Berkshire back in 1986. And Abel runs the energy business and all the other subsidiaries. I guess a lot of folks are looking at Abel as the likelier pick because he's 55 and Jane is 66. I mean, I don't know. When the guy's 87, I don't know who has actually seen like 66, 55, kind of the same thing, right?
Okay. So I remember back in 2008, during the financial crisis, Warren Buffett, while everybody was selling their stocks, Warren Buffett wrote this opinion piece in the New York Times calling on people to buy American stocks. He said, over the long run, the stock market news will be good. And it turned out he was right. He made a lot of money for being right. What do you think people are going to be wondering about what he thinks about the current volatility in the stock market?
Well, I would say that he's the kind of guy who's probably going to say this is very good for the market. You know, he is also the person who says that nothing sedates rationality like large doses of effortless money, meaning like if you've just been making a ton of money since 2008, don't hang around and act as if that's going to go on forever. And I think that he's, you know, obviously famously said, be fearful when others are greedy and be greedy when others are fearful. But in the current environment, I think he's also likely to talk a little bit about how this is not going to go on forever. And that's what it means to be an investor. And he's really good at pounding that point home.
And Berkshire Hathaway, by the way, has a lot of money in treasury bills right now in bonds.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sitting on a ton of money, I might add. He's got $100 billion in cash. Wow. And, you know, Berkshire doesn't pay dividends out right now. Maybe in the post-Buffett era that will occur. But I guess he feels like they haven't found a great company to buy. It's 2 years since the last major purchase, $32 billion for Precision Castparts. So we're waiting to see whether Buffett's going to announce something else that's new and exciting for him.
I interviewed him several years ago, Jill, and I asked him what he got at McDonald's because he famously goes to McDonald's, and he said he has a special order that they call the McBuffet. You can Google it and then go order it yourself. See if they know what it means.
That's a good thing. And by the way, you know, be prepared. There is always something in there for everyone.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
A conservative student group at the University of California, Los Angeles, recently invited controversial right-wing personality Milo Yiannopoulos to speak at a campus fundraiser. Then they did something interesting. 24 hours later, they rescinded that invitation. Mariela Muro is a junior at UCLA and a member of the Bruin Republicans, and she wrote about the group's decision in the Weekly Standard, and she joins us. And Mariela, obviously, just about everyone has the right to say whatever they want, wherever they want in the United States. So tell us why your club decided to disinvite Yiannopoulos.
Well, like you said, absolutely. You know, Milo has every right to speak. But I guess my objection was basically that I didn't want my club to host him. On a liberal campus, for a conservative group, it's very difficult to get our ideals across, especially when you have, you know, a very hostile environment towards conservative ideals. If we look at the bigger picture, it's not just about provoking. It's about actually getting our message across and to be very strategic about it. You know, we have to take into consideration our audience. You know, who are we dealing with? So many of the members in my club also disagreed with the invitation. So it's not, I don't want to make it seem like it was just one person in the whole group that objected or, you know, like I was some kind of hero. I mean, I was obviously the only one that took it public because I thought it was an important issue to bring to the forefront. So
you write that your mission isn't necessarily to provoke, but to spread conservative ideals. So tell me more about that. Like how is it that you could accomplish that on campus?
I think if we say something that's truthful and people get offended or get are provoked, that's just the consequence of, you know, what we have to say. But I think it would be counterproductive to present our ideas, which are already unpopular on campus, right? And then do it with, you know, this kind of comedian kind of character who, you know, I'm sure he probably presents some good points. You know, I give him that, you know, but I don't think he was worth the fall of our group or the potential fall of our group on campus. We believe these things because we fundamentally think they're right, you know. We don't believe in limited government just because Democrats or the left wants big government, you know. We actually believe these things because we believe in philosophy, you know. We think this is the right thing to do. We're not just doing this to make the left mad or, you know, to trigger snowflakes. You know, this is actually what we believe in. And we don't do this for them. We do this for ourselves. For other conservatives, we're not going to change how we feel about things because people are going to get upset. But our prime objective isn't to make them upset.
And I wonder, I mean, we're having this conversation right now as CPAC is going on. This is the national stage for the conservatives. We've got speakers from the far right, from France and the UK coming. Wayne LaPierre yesterday was warning of what he saw as the evils of socialism. Dana Loesch, also a spokesperson for the NRA, smeared the media, saying the media loves mass shootings. I'm just wondering, from your view as a campus Republican, what do you make of those voices of conservatism that are speaking out nationally right now?
You know, as a conservative, I tend to focus on the things that bring us together rather than focus on what separates us or what divides us. At the end of the day, I think the main principles of the conservative movement, you know, limited government, which is, I think, the most crucial and fundamental. I think especially living in California, you know, we see the polarization. Conservatives are such a minority. We shouldn't be so caught up in what makes us different. I mean, obviously, we should be able to express, you know, how we differ. At CPAC, you know, they have tons of conservative speakers, you know, which take many different positions. And I think that's great. You know, I support free speech and, you know, I might not agree with every conservative, but I tend to look at, you know, what brings us together. That's crucial in this type of, you know, polarizing environment.
Yeah. Do you see conservative first principles as the guide star for the Republican Party right now or not? The party of Donald Trump, the party of Donald Trump, essentially.
I mean, I don't know. I can't really say if they agree with me or not. But I think, like I said, I think the best thing to do is to focus on, you know, what we have in common, and not focus on, you know, what separates us or how we differ. And I think that'd be the best strategic way to make a stronger movement, especially in this kind of polarizing environment where conservatives are kind of, I mean, I wouldn't say they're an oppressed class, but we definitely are put in the shadows. I think conservatives, I think like people that support Donald Trump or, you know, other conservatives, I think they know that. I think they're, you know, pretty smart about it that, you know, sure, we have these differences, but at the end of the day, we're all conservatives and we're all dealing with kind of the same issues in the same environment. Mm.
Well, Mariela Muro is a junior at UCLA and a member of the Bruin Republicans. Mariela, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This week marks a time of remembrance for a dark spot in American history. In February 1942, in the aftermath of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the U.S. entry into World War II, President Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order that allowed the government to put Americans of Japanese descent into internment camps. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle takes us to the site of one of those camps in Colorado.
The government built 10 internment camps, a majority of them in western interior states. Barbed wire, guard towers armed with machine guns, and searchlights surrounded the perimeters.
They had nowhere to go.
That's John Toney, a photography professor at the University of Northern Colorado. He spent years photographing these sites.
It's a very, very small part of what happened in America that most people don't get.
Toney isn't just speaking from an academic's point of view. His parents, his grandparents, aunts and uncles lived through this.
And I turn left here.
Yeah.
On a frigid February day, he takes me to the site of the relocation camp in southeast Colorado, where his dad's side of the family lived for 3 years.
Machi Japanese-American relocation center.
It was the summer of 1942 when his family arrived here from their hometown of Los Angeles. They came in trains with the shades pulled down, so they couldn't see much outside along the way. When they got out, they saw a hastily built military camp on a bare, sandy hill outside Grenada, Colorado. They were assigned to live in a barrack like this one.
So it would have been one light bulb.
A bare light bulb, a potbelly stove, cots for the bed, and that's about it.
Outside, it was plains in all directions. There wasn't a single tree. The internees took care of that pretty quickly. They bought elm tree saplings and planted them all around camp.
I think to make it look less austere. Because imagine if you didn't have weeds, it just was flat ground.
No one knew how long they'd have to stay here. But over the 3 years of its existence, the site held more than 7,300 internees.
It was a city. It functioned like a normal city, except that there was barbed wire and guard towers.
In fact, it became the 10th largest city in Colorado. Boy Scouts raised the American flag every day at the elementary school. Residents built koi ponds and grew vegetables. There was even a tofu factory and a silkscreen shop where internees printed recruitment posters for the U.S. Navy. But Tonai says making the best of a bad situation didn't erase the pain of being labeled an enemy. He says his relatives were full of shame and anger.
That they were locked up. That they were different. That they were considered potentially an enemy.
Internment was hard on everyone, but at least the kids could go to school. Tonai's grandfather had been a fisherman. He didn't have anything to do out here in the dry plains. So instead, he started trapping birds and hunting rattlesnakes.
He'd kill the rattlesnakes. He'd cut off the rattles. And when I was younger, he gave me one whole skin, a bunch of rattles, and a couple of their fangs.
It was 3 years before the war ended and Tonai's family returned to California to start rebuilding their lives. When they did, Tonai's grandfather brought something with him.
He dug up a cactus and put in a little vase and took it to L.A. with him.
It was a scraggly little cactus, about the size of a fist.
It had to have been really special to my grandfather for him to care, but it just, to me, just doesn't make sense because it came from such a, maybe because it came from such a bad place.
Tonai says for as long as his grandfather lived, he barely mentioned the camp, but he kept that little cactus alive, prominently displayed at the front of the house. These days, Tonai says the news keeps reminding him about that piece of history.
You know, I remember the first time I saw the America First slogan, and I thought, are we returning to that kind of attitude?
To that particular brand of fear and nationalism, he says, that led to his family's imprisonment. It turns out others may be thinking the same thing. For years, Americans of Japanese descent have made annual pilgrimages to visit one of the bigger internment camps, Manzanar, in California. Lately, they've started inviting along their Muslim neighbors. For Here and Now, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
And Ray's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
The Department of Justice is renewing its attention on the murder of an assistant U.S. attorney. Thomas Wales was killed in Seattle nearly 17 years ago. There's a reward for information that leads to an arrest and conviction in this case, and this week it was raised to $1.5 million. And Tom and Amy Wales, the son and daughter of the slain prosecutor, released this video.
His murder remains unsolved, and we need your help to find his killer.
One tip is all that it takes. If you have any information, no matter how small, please contact the FBI. You can do so confidently.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a CNN legal analyst. He's been following this case, and he joins us now. Jeff, it's good to have you.
Hi.
So first of all, I mean, Thomas Wales was mentioned 17 or so years ago, 2001. Why is there renewed attention on this case now?
Well, that's a great question, and frankly, I can't figure out the answer to that. I'm glad there is renewed attention. It is, it's a horrible crime. It's unsolved. But Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, went to Seattle earlier this week and held a news conference to announce that they were raising the reward from $1 million to $1.5 million for information leading to a conviction. But in terms of progress in the investigation, the FBI said they have been doing interviews. They are still conducting an investigation. But based on anything I've seen, they seem pretty stumped, or at least pretty stymied is perhaps the better word for it.
Okay. So Wales was, 49 when he was killed, and he was shot to death through a window while he was sitting at his computer. It was a prosecutor of white-collar crime in Seattle. I mean, are there any theories as to theories to the case?
Oh, there's a theory, and there's only been one theory ever since he was assassinated. And, you know, it's important to point out that this was in no way a random crime. This was a targeted assassination. It was 10:30 at night, the Queen Anne neighborhood, very quiet part of Seattle. A rifle blast through a window using an unusual kind of weapon. And Tom Wales was a good prosecutor, but he was a very methodical one. Another word for that is slow. He didn't bring many cases. And he had brought a case very recently where the defendant was acquitted in a very embarrassing way for the government. The government had to drop the charges in the middle of the trial. But that defendant was so angry about being prosecuted that he actually filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Attorney's Office. That lawsuit was dismissed, but that defendant's anger, particularly at Tom Wales, made him basically the only suspect that's ever come to light in this case over all these years.
Hmm. Now, I mean, this also must be a particular challenge for the FBI. I mean, here's the murder of a fellow member of the Justice Department, a fellow federal employee, that they haven't been able to close this case.
It's terribly frustrating. And, you know, if we assume, and I think it is correct to assume, that Tom Wales was killed in the line of duty, that would make him the only federal prosecutor in all of American history killed in the line of duty. So it's a very serious and disturbing case. There has been a suspect for all these years. There is evidence tying this man to the crime. He, I need to say in fairness, through his attorney, has always denied any sort of involvement. But even with all those leads, that they have failed to make this case, I would say, is a pretty big embarrassment.
Well, so Jeff,
for
can
the
I just
Justice Department?
Yeah, can I just ask you a question about that? Because I mean, is this just one of those cases where the hard work of a criminal investigation also takes time? In this case, a lot of time. And when leads run cold, they just run cold. Or is there some sort of failing here within the FBI?
Well, that's a good question, and I can't answer it. And the answer may be both. This certainly is a failure on the part of the FBI, but they have been working on the case, and it does not seem to be for lack of effort that no charges have been brought. You know, one of the weird things about this case is that it took place in October of 2001, when the country was, of course, transfixed on 9/11. So the case never got the attention, even in Seattle, that it really deserves. And I think one reason why the authorities are trying to call attention to it again is to generate attention and to generate leads. You know, this is a quiet part of Seattle, but it is part of Seattle, and there are a lot of people around. And certainly the suspect was around Seattle on the day of the murder. So I do think it's a good thing that prosecutors and the FBI are trying to shake the tree and see if anyone can come forward. But it is sort of hard to believe that a witness who hadn't come forward for almost 17 years is going to come forward now. But I guess the argument is there's no harm in trying.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and CNN legal analyst. Jeff, thanks so much. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.